Thanks, Microsoft, for hosting. Startups are a collaborative sport. It takes a lot of people to make them work, and it's not easy. Most startups fail, we all know that. But when they succeed, boy, is it magical, huh? And that's why we all do it. Most days as an entrepreneur are going to be hard, and very few days are going to be easy. And that's why it's so important that you pick a product or a service or a market, customers that you absolutely love. Pick something that you love, because you're going to wake up most days as an entrepreneur and you're going to be just going to get punched in the face. You're going to be tripping and falling. It's going to be awkward. But boy, I tell you, as an angel investor, when you see the awkward startup, two people with an idea and nobody believes in them, and then 6 months later, two or three more people believe in them, 2 or 3 years later, 90% of people believe in them, and then 6 or 7 years later, everybody's trying to take credit for the success of that startup. Like, it's hilarious to watch. I see it over and over again. When I'm most famous, obviously, for being the third or fourth investor in Uber, I got super lucky in that case. And I emailed an intro to about 20 VCs. I held a little event called Open Angel Forum on the pier over here, invited 10 angel investors. This is before AngelList and SeedInvest and all these great platforms. Nobody knew who the angel investors were. Travis came, he pitched. 14 out of 16 people in the room, 14 out of 17 people in the room said no. 3 people said yes. I was in a board meeting with one of the people who said no. They said, I had this sense that it was gonna work. I said, why didn't you invest? And they said, well, there were so many reasons of why it wouldn't work. And I said, you know, that's a really good observation. Startups are about not the long list of why something is not gonna work. Anybody can do that. It's very easy to be negative in life. It's very easy to look at all the problems and challenges and say, yeah, it's not gonna work. But what if it does? What if it does work? Even if it's a 1 in 100 chance or a 1 in 1,000 or, you know, Tesla, Elon's company, God, that was a 1 in 1,000,000 or 1 in 1,000, who knows? But what if it does work? That's the magic of what we do as entrepreneurs and startups. And boy, have things changed in the last 25 years since I got started. You need less money to get started. But there's more competition. But there's more resources out there. And this huge divide that there used to be between the big companies like Microsoft and startups, you know what? It's closing. Why? The big companies look at these small companies and say, wow, they're so fast, they're so massively innovative, we need to get involved with them earlier. And so it's really great to have partners like Microsoft, we've been partners with them for years, because they're looking at this saying, hey, it's impossible for all the smart people in the world to work at Microsoft. There are many more smart people outside of the building, just on a statistical basis, in any large company than there are inside the building. And that's the great collaborative nature of the technology industry. We're very lucky in our industry. It's not a petty industry like, I don't know, finance or advertising or Hollywood. In our industry, people want to support each other. People want to try to help. And that's what we do at our company, the Launch Company. Our mission, to support founders, inspire innovation. Everything we do is around those two goals. So Launch Festival, anybody ever been to Launch Festival? Awesome. Did any of you pay for a ticket? Raise your hand if you bought a ticket. That's what I like to see. Like, two of you bought tickets, that's great. I appreciate that. You came to some fancy dinners, we hung out, it was pretty great. We took some selfies, did some shots, awesome. But I always said to myself, hey, if I ever make it in the industry, I wanna make the most inclusive open platform ever. And that's what we're doing at Launch. Launch Incubator, thank you. Launch Incubator, This Week in Startups, our This Week in Startups live series, the email newsletter. Everything we do is just about trying to support founders a little bit. So we just hope that when you come to one of our events, you learn something, you meet somebody, a co-founder, an investor, you get inspired. Something happens that just helps you just a little bit get closer to your dream and to what you want to have happen in the world. And I am in a very lucky position. I have to tell you, I have the greatest job in the world. My job is to listen to crazy people who want to change the world and then gamble and make a bet essentially every week. We do 40, 50 investments a year. I'm a professional gambler in the future. How lucky am I? It's like literally the greatest job in the world. Hear crazy ideas and then once in a while write a check and see if we can try to make them happen. And this event today is one of the things I love to do most. I love to meet people who watch the show. Has anybody been to a This Week in Startups Live before? Raise your hand if you've been to one of these before. Awesome. And now that you're on the list, you're going to be first to go to one of the next ones. So we always try to reward people by inviting them to the next one and make everything free. You know, we can't make these things free without partners. So over time, we made the tickets to the event, we made being on stage free, then we made the tickets to the event free, then we gave 250 startups free demo pit tables this year. And all of that is possible based on two factors. One, me losing money. Try not to do that too often, team, please. And two, having really big, awesome partners who will help pay for the pie, help pick the apples and not just eat the pie. I have to tell you, so many people call me, hey, Jason, love what you're doing. Is there any way I can sell my product or service at your events? And I'm like, want to help me pick some apples? And they're like, no, I just want to eat the pie. I'm like, kind of need people to help pick the apples too. And Microsoft is one of those people who really supports our organization in helping pay for the drinks, pay for the AV, and make these things happen. So I just want to give one big round of applause to my friends at Microsoft. And with that, my favorite thing in the world to do is talk to entrepreneurs about their ideas, and in this incredibly privileged position I am to hear, you know, all these ideas and then work in our launch incubator, I kind of know where the bodies are buried and some of the minds are located. So hopefully I'll be able to give you some decent advice. And let's just start off with our first question or pitch. Okay, here we go. You got 60 seconds on the clock. Three, two.
Hi, I'm JP Martin and our company is GrowX. We are developing a fully integrated hardware and software platform that addresses some of indoor growing's largest challenges, which are high electricity costs, limited productivity per square foot, and lack of product consistency from plant to plant, room to room, and grow to grow. All while providing growers with an unprecedented level of control over their growing environment, and in the case of our go-to-market crop of cannabis, including the baked-in seed-to-sale compliance and tracking, or the regulatory component of the industry, or what I like to think of as the ERP for cannabis.
Okay, keep going.
So these are our pods. These units are 4 feet in diameter by 6 feet tall and are optimized for the growth of any sort of high light intensity fruiting and flowering crop. They reduce water consumption over soil farming by 98%. They reduce electrical consumption over the traditional technology systems in terms of lighting and HVAC by 50%, and triple a grower's available canopy space in the same square footage, all other factors being equal, allowing them to triple their yields within the same floor space, and these units will stack. So this is kind of a big vision of what a farm of the future could look like. And we do have a video. I don't know if we have time for that. But
good, play it, and I'll talk over it, I guess.
This is a demo of our first prototype. Super quick and rough and dirty, but here it is. It does exist. There is no audio.
No problem. So you built this?
I did.
And it's got some lighting on the inside?
It does. LED lighting?
LED lighting.
LED lighting.
And it's... recycles the water, I'm assuming, in some way, or?
It does not. Don't need to recycle the water because of how little water it uses.
Ah, got it.
You could recycle the water, but the plants actually give off hormones, and so that ends up contaminating the water, and so you want to just get rid of it.
Ah, got it. Okay, so number one, cannabis is going to be legal in our lifetime on a national basis. That was one of the things Obama in private talked about during his first term. He's told people, I know, we're going to address the legalization or decriminalization of cannabis and drug reform in our country, but I'm not going to do it in the first 4 years, first term. I'm going to do it in my second term because I want to get reelected. So you're actually in the right place at the right time. You're a little bit early or maybe perfectly on time because the world is quickly changing their attitudes about a number of issues. And I think that's a great thing about the moment in time we live in. We live in a time of change and when people are embracing it. So if you look at just people's feelings on gay marriage or cannabis usage, the number of people approving is going like this and the disapproving is going like this. And then somewhere like maybe 5-6 years ago, those lines crossed for gay marriage and equal rights, for cannabis, and it will continue that kind of change. The question I have for you about this business is, what's defensible about it? That's the question you're going to get most of all, is what's defensible about this? And then what's the margin on something like this? Because people are hacking this kind of stuff all the time, and it's kind of open sourcey in terms of the sharing information. I've seen a bunch of people building grow pods.
Absolutely.
So what's unique here?
Yeah, so we filed.
And what's defensible?
Sure. So we filed two provisional patents and one full PCT application with our attorneys at Kenobi Martins.
Okay.
There are various components that I think will be defensible. There's a lot that's not, but mm-hmm. whatever sticks, sticks. And we are very much kind of first movers in the space. I think that our advantage is going to come on the software side of things. The my experience as a software developer at Elon Musk SpaceX, so I was a developer there on their proprietary ERP system, brings a lot of sophistication to this industry where the bar is pretty low.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's going to be a big advantage for us. As far as the return on investment, the uplift in yield and a reduction of operational expenses allows growers to basically the system to pay for itself in 6 months or less.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, you're massively producing more and then at a higher quality and higher price.
How have orders been? How do you have pre-orders? Did you kickstart this? How are you funding it? Because hardware is hard.
Absolutely. To date, we've raised just under $75,000 in angel investment. That's gotten us prototypes, all of the corporate and IP work, and we have 10 clients that are ready to participate in a pilot that we hope to launch in November. So we're currently doing a $1.5 million seed round led by Tandem Capital out of Burlingame. We also have participation from AITB out of San Diego. John Lonsdale's on their board.
Lonsdale's on the board too. Yeah, he's doing Hyperloop and some other big.
John Lonsdale.
Oh, John Lonsdale.
Yes.
Yeah. Not Joe.
Right.
Are they related?
Brothers.
They're brothers. Okay. So I think the key for this business, number one, it's pretty surprising to me that professional investors are investing. That's the first time I've heard. Are they investing from funds or are they investing as individuals?
Funds.
So that's good.
We are technically hands off the plant.
Right, because most of the funds have, maybe people don't know this, but if you have an angel or a venture fund, there are some morality clauses, ethic clauses, legality clauses. You can't invest in certain things.
We've run into that.
Yeah, and so that's a decade-long change. So a decade from now, I predict in all of those funds, cannabis will, when it becomes like coffee, which is pretty close to happening, I think it's like about a 10-year window, that'll reset. You have to figure out a way to continue to fund and continue to survive. I think proving it by getting people to order in advance and pay in advance is one of the great, great innovations of the last 10 years in hardware. So I'd encourage you to either do a Kickstarter, on Kickstarter, off Kickstarter. I don't know if they allow these kind of things. I'm sure Indiegogo will, because Indiegogo's behind everybody else. And I think you have to have those alternative funding sources lined up, because hardware companies always run out of money. I cannot tell you how many times a hardware company has come to me on their third bridge, their fourth bridge. They're almost there. Whatever amount of money you need, it's five times more. You think you need 1.5, you need 7. You think you need 7, you need 35. So just be very, very clever about getting money in ahead of time. So the great innovator in this space was your old boss at SpaceX, where you know Elon has now sold almost 400,000 cars in advance, got a $1,000 deposit,
yes.
Pretty impressive. But he did that after selling just 200 Model Tesla Roadsters. The Tesla Roadster, he attempted to sell 100 in advance. I think he got to like 80 or 90, then eventually 200 or 300. With the Model S, he tried to do 1,000 signature series, and now with this new car, he just did the $1,000 deposit. So there's some legality issues around that. In fact, in the initial Tesla Roadster, you were joining a club. You weren't buying the car. You were like joining a club, and it was like this very weird legal document.
Interesting.
That I was like, Elon, what is this? And he's like, yeah, it's like sort of a, and I was like, I don't give a fuck. Like, let's go.
Let's
make
go
an electric
it,
car,
yeah.
Right? So you have to be able to identify those people and have that reoccurring source of revenue. Get good at that. Get good at people buying the 1.0, the 1.5, the 2, the 2.5 ahead of time. And I think there's actually going to be another thing that's going to be wind in your sails is people are want to do local ag. It's a big, big, big model. How much does that unit cost that we saw?
The bill of materials on it right now is estimated to be right around $5,000, but 70% of that is the LED cost.
Got it.
There's something called Heitz's law, which is the equivalent for Moore's law for LEDs.
Got it.
Every 10 years, the efficiencies of LEDs improves by a factor of 20, while the cost is reduced by a factor of 10. So over time, our cost will come down dramatically, and operational costs for the units will come down, and that will make the economics of indoor farming for other crops make sense.
Ah, yes, because tomatoes are cheaper than cannabis.
Right, but they require just as much light.
Right. So selling this to somebody who wants to do heirloom tomatoes at a great restaurant is...
Today would not make sense.
Would not make sense.
Today.
So I think that's another good stretch goal for you is when some Michelin-starred chef wants to put five of these on display in their restaurant and show, like, here are the tomatoes that we're doing for the next 3 months and people can see them. Like, this could be an amazing, amazing sort of innovation as well.
So we're also talking to some 100-point winemakers in Napa about essentially using these machines to engineer a wine grape to the exact skin thickness and Brix levels for making the perfect wine, but it would definitely be one of more of those niche markets.
Don't rely on investors' money. Rely on customers' money is the number one piece of advice I can give you. You sound like you're a really good salesperson and you're gonna be able to get some early investor interest, but after you need extension after extension, the way you're gonna be able to keep raising money is by having those pre-orders and by having those deposits. So really understand and figure that out and don't discount that just because you're good at raising money. Because I know people who are good at raising money, they didn't do these Kickstarter things, they're like, yeah, I don't need to do a Kickstarter, I just raise money from investors. And then they weren't in control of their destiny and they didn't have the positive feedback loop of, hey, we put a product out there and only 70 people bought it. You really want to be able to challenge yourself to say, when I put a product out there, when I announce a new feature, I'm able to get press and get 100 more pre-orders. And listen, that discipline is what makes, you know, Elon so good at what he does. Like when he put that Model 3 up there after having done Roadster, S, and X, he was so much more polished at, you know, and so much more confident and so much better at, so much more credibility. So keep building your credibility, keep delivering the betas, and look at your customers as a source of financing. And I think actually you might be a perfect candidate for the new Title III funding. I think those Title III, you understand what that is, Title III?
I believe so.
It means civilians, 97% of Americans are gonna be able to, who are not accredited investors,
right,
in the minds of our government, poor people who are too stupid to know what to do with their own money. Is really how our government looks at it. Like, we have to protect these 97% of people from making bets on startups. Feel free to go to Vegas and bet on black, but God forbid you bet on a promising product you use. Like, how many people here used Facebook before it went public? Anybody here use Facebook before it went public? Anybody here have a sense when they were using Facebook that this could be big? Raise your hand if you thought it could be big. Right, it's like almost everybody would have gotten that bet right. It was a pretty obvious one. So here, this could be a pretty obvious bet, and I think you could raise $1 million doing that as well. And you're the perfect non-traditional company to do that, where the people who are investing might be investing because they have an affinity for the product and or space. They're enthusiasts, you know. And two, their expectation of return might be 2, 3, 4x their money, whereas, you know, people like me, we're looking for 100x minimum. So anyway, it's a great pitch. The product looks tight, and you seem very credible. I give the pitch like 8.5 out of 10 right now. So big round of applause for JP.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you, This Week in Startups. Thank you, Jackie.
Hey, I'm Jason.
Hi, Jason.
Catherine West Webster.
That's in tech.
Catherine has a question.
Okay, a question. Sit or stand, we could do either. It's up to you.
Okay, I'll go ahead and sit, actually.
Okay, you stand. I'm
so I'm Catherine Webster with Vets in Tech, and well, it's Military Appreciation Month, so hug a veteran. I am asking this question on behalf of veteran entrepreneurs, but it applies to any entrepreneur.
Sure.
So just please, if you could let us know, what are the top three things you advise entrepreneurs when looking for funding?
Okay, specifically for vets or for everybody?
Everybody.
For everybody, okay. So number one, are you in the military?
Military family.
Oh, you're military family. Well, Thank you for your service, because you know what? The people who have to send their loved ones over, big round of applause for that, yeah. I mean, it really is a lot of times the spouses and the kids who are making a bigger sacrifice than, you know, or as big a sacrifice as the people going over there. So we appreciate that, especially since we don't have to put ourselves in harm's way. So top advice for entrepreneurs raising money. Okay, so knowing when to approach people is critical, right? And doing your research on investors. The great investors are out there and they have portfolio companies, they do interviews in most cases. Many times they get a cold email from somebody who hasn't listened to the 100 interviews I've given about myself or the 650 that I've done for This Week in Startups. And they don't follow my Twitter and they don't follow my LinkedIn or any of the other things I'm doing. And I'm always fascinated that they don't know that I don't do music investment, because music startups always fail. It's really hard. Almost universally, it's a difficult business. And so I say to them, like, did you ever hear me say that? Oh, no, I never heard that. Okay. So knowing the investor and then knowing the timing of that investor is so critical. If you're dealing with somebody who's at a VC firm, and you look at their portfolio and say, wow, they've done B and C rounds, but I don't see any A rounds. Okay, it's not the right time for me to go there. Okay, what are the companies that they invested in the B and C round, and who did the A round? Great. Now, who did the A round? Who before them did their seed round? Okay, and the seed round, did they go to an incubator before that? Right? So really doing your research. This idea of a shotgun approach is the exact wrong one, to use military terms. You want to be a sniper. You want to pick a target. You want to study the target. You want to know the wind speed. I mean, you really want to really think about who you're going after. When you do go after them, I suggest that you work on your execution and making every aspect of your execution exceptional, right? And this is something the military does very well, right? They're very focused on details and being exceptional. So if you look at the letter you write, the screenshots you share, the name of your company, when we're on the other side of the table, we're actually thinking about all that stuff. So, you know, when you're, I'll just give you a couple of examples. When I went to raise money for my startup, I had the domain name 20.com and mahalo.com. And I went into Sequoia and I was showing them my concept for a human-powered search engine, Wikipedia plus Google. And I was showing it to two of the most famous venture capitalist at the time, Michael Moritz, and his new protege, Roelof Botha, who had just done his first investment in a video platform called YouTube with some people who had he had known from PayPal. And the first thing they noticed was like, oh, the domain name 20.com and the domain name mahalo.com. We know what mahalo means. It means thank you. And then you have 20.com. How did you get those domain names? I'm like, well, I paid $75 for that one, and I paid $16,000 for that one, and I'm testing them, and here's what I'm trying to figure out. It immediately built credibility. Oh, he's got a serious domain name. So when com.com came to me and we're on the program, I was like, oh, mindful meditation. I was like, how did you get com.com? It's a $1 million domain name. And he explained to me, Alex, too, who's a great entrepreneur. Alex explained to me how he got the domain name for much less than $1 million. And I was like, okay, if you can get com.com for a song, this has proven to me that one, you're great at branding, two, you have a big vision, three, you have the ability to negotiate with somebody and get that prime asset, right? So number one, pick the right target and study them like a hawk. Number two, when you approach them, have exceptional execution. You don't want to come to them when you're in the idea phase. That means nothing. So coming with one customer that loves your product is better than having 1,000 PowerPoint slides. Having three beautiful images of your app, gorgeously designed, is better than having all the research in the world and a 20-point deck. Having a mock-up of that would be even better, right? So when you bring the product to them, you want it to be massively credible and have excellence on all levels. Well, how do you know if it's excellent? Well, you can just look at your contemporaries. So I literally have people send me an app design, and I'm like, wow, you have not read my blog or not listened to anything I've said, because I tell everybody how important design is in today's day and age and how easy it is. Here are all the hacks for having great design. And you sent me a 4 out of 10 design, 5 out of 10 design. It's like, can't you get $1,000 together or beg somebody in college to redo your design and make it at least an 8.5 or a 9? In the previous pitch by JP, we saw the product looked pretty tight, right? The design was pretty beautiful. His deck was solid. That started to build credibility with me. He knew his build of materials. He had worked at SpaceX. Lots of little credibility. I'm taking notes on all that stuff. Maybe I'll do a follow-up meeting with him. So pick the right person, do your research, have perfect timing when you come to meet with them. And then it is a numbers game. And so staying in touch with people and taking an arc is very important. So Mark Suster writes this, connecting the dots to make lines. So your goal is not to get money from people on the first time you meet them. Your goal is to get the meeting. Your goal after getting the first meeting is to get a second meeting with more partners at a firm, or, you know, a longer meeting, and to really take notes and listen to what they said. So I've had people come back to me 2 years later, and in fact, com.com is a perfect example of that. He asked me to invest. I was like, nah, you know, the product, it's just like a web page, but come back to me when you have an app or whatever. He came back to me in an app. I was like, this looks pretty good. I wound up putting $400,000 into it. People literally wrote a whole Quora thread about, wow, Jason's going to be a terrible angel investor if he's stupid and invests in a meditation app. I looked at the long arc of history and said, well, Phil Jackson's doing mindfulness, UCLA has a mindful session, like I'm doing mindful meditation, like there's something here. Wisdom, all this stuff. And like, okay, now the world's caught up with calm.com. So that's an investment that happened maybe 12, 18 months after I met them. So three things. One, pick the right target, research them. Two, execution is everything. Make sure every detail is executed. Spelling errors, shitty design, technology that doesn't work. I mean, you can be a little bit awkward as a startup. You can be the awkward teenager. You just can't have like, you know, stuff that just shows a lack of pride, right? Have pride in the work. And then number three, take a, you know, long arc, because what the entrepreneurs that investors love to invest in are the indefatigable ones. Indefatigable. There is no way to stop that entrepreneur. You get that sense with some people. Like, you just know, like, people like Evan Williams or Mark Pincus or Melody at Styleseat, like, when I met them, it's just like, they're not going to stop. Travis, you know, Marco at Thumbtack, you just know they're just, no matter what happens, they're going to keep going. And so being indefatigable, never giving up, and taking a long view of it, that's really important too. It's a great question, and thank you for it.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Thank you.
All right. I think we're cruising. I'm averaging about 47 minutes per answer.
I'm putting a minute on the clock. I'll put a minute because I don't think I can do 90 seconds.
Okay. Now. 1 minute on the clock. Here we go. A great question, number
Thank
one.
You, Jamal,
and
for
a great pitch. We're starting off strong here. All right. Here we go. 1 minute. Okay, everybody's having PTSD looking at apartment searches and renting houses. How brutal is real estate in San Francisco right now? Oh my God.
I just learned that. I landed yesterday. Someone said it took them 6.5 months to find a month-to-month rental.
Yeah, it's a disaster.
It's
okay,
crazy.
So welcome.
So
what's
I always
like
to say Keenan Williams.
Keenan, I'm Jason.
Nice to meet you, Jason.
Okay, three, two, go.
Before 60 seconds. Before I start speaking, let me take a quick survey. I'd like to know my audience. Who's rented in less than an hour? I found an apartment. I saw it. I liked it. I applied. I got approved, and I rented in less than an hour. Raise your hand if it took you more than a week to rent an apartment. Great. So majority of the room are my customers, including Jason. So I'm Keenan Williams, co-founder of Resy. What we're doing is something very complicated, but also very simple. At Resy, we're building a rental experience of the future. So what exactly does that mean? At the end of the day, landlords and tenants all have the same five pain points. So for a tenant, it takes you forever to get an application in, pass the broker, get the application approved, background check received, and then absolutely struggle with setting a key pickup date to move in. End to end, that could be anywhere from 15 days to 3 months. For landlords, it's the same thing. They have troubles, the do-it-yourselfers, of collecting rental payments, repairs and maintenance, service providing. So what Resy is doing is building an end-to-end solution for the entire industry of single-family rental homes to start, not apartments. So any unit that's a single-family home, up to three units, we're being their entire service provider in a digital way. So the tenant is going to apply, get approved, move in all through their phone. The landlord is going to do the same, a digital dashboard to run all their analytics, income and expenses. And more importantly, it's a marketplace that simply does what everyone else has done before. We match demand and supply. That's Resy.
Okay. I love this pitch. This is a product or service that is desperately needed. And I invested in it 3 years ago. It's called Cozy. You're aware of Cozy.
Well, they're a property management software solution. They're SaaS, yes.
Yep. And they're doing great.
They are.
And so my first question would be, how is it different than the company I invested in 3 years ago that is absolutely crushing it with the same exact pitch?
Sure. So it's actually a bit of a different pitch. And for everyone that doesn't know, Cozy is a property management solution software. So if I use Cozy, I have to manually type in all the data. I have to manually send in specifics for repairs and maintenance. A digital landlord like Resy does it on behalf of the owner. So ownership doesn't speak to the tenant. Resy speaks to the tenant.
So you're doing property management.
That's one aspect.
One aspect. So there are some overlaps with Cozy in
Absolutely.
Terms of applications and managing payments.
Correct.
Which is their big thing.
Right.
But you're adding the level of, I'm going to manage the property so when something breaks like a boiler, You call us, not the landlord.
Right. So what Resi did is nothing crazy. A wise person once said that innovation is just two old ideas that have met for the first time. So what we've done is we've combined property management software solutions, ACH payment collection, and tenant sourcing, all in one end-to-end solution.
Yeah. So it's... I think that you're obviously I would really study the market and what they've done, because they've done three of the four things you're describing. The one piece that I guess is this property management, and doing the maintenance. Explain that to me and how much that costs and how do you charge for it? What's the business model?
So one of the biggest pain points for rental owners is repairs and maintenance, i.e. my tenant's sink broke, and that I have to, as a do-it-yourselfer, go out and get a third party or show up to myself to fix it. What Resi does is we have a dashboard that is a tenant-specific dashboard. So they say, Resi, my toilet's broken. Same day, we send out service providers. So the owner doesn't have to price out, doesn't have to figure out who's going to do the better bid or try to fix it themselves.
Yep.
Resi does it on their behalf and then takes it out the rental fee.
Now, I love this one quarter of your idea.
Sure.
This is the best part of it.
Oh, no, it's not.
Of the four pieces, I think it's the best part, in my opinion. And I love it so much that we just had a company go through the incubator called Butter, which I invested in. And what Butter is doing is they do your home management just one-to-one. So if I own a property, they will, for $50 or $100 a month, and $100 a month sounds like a lot, but if you own $1 million or more house, it's not even 1% of the cost.
Correct.
So over 10 years, it would be 1%. And they manage everything. So they inventory your whole home, look at your stove, how old it is, your hot water heater. And they tell you, by the way, this hot water heater is 12 years old. It's going to break in the next 3 years. It's this lack of efficiency. There's this rebate.
Yep.
And we have somebody who's a preferred vendor who will install it for this amount, will come for $40 an hour and do everything.
Yep.
So this property management piece is also very palatable. So
absolutely. And we're doing that in New York City.
But what's that?
To your point, we're doing it in New York City.
Good.
But to your point, we think the other end is pretty great as well. So the service provider of fixing repairs and maintenance to the owner is one thing. But for a tenant, if you apply to Resi, from the minute you swipe right, I like the property, all the way into the point of actually key pickup date selection, every iterative step is done through your phone in less than 30 minutes. So if you fit the Resi credit box, one thing that no one else can do is you get instant rent.
So here's how, so what I always do with entrepreneurs, red pill or blue pill? Do you want to stay in the matrix or do you want candid advice?
I want the best advice you got.
Okay. That means he's taking the red pill gives you the harsh reality.
Yes.
And the blue pill keeps you in the matrix thinking everything's hunky-dory.
Yeah.
Here's the red pill. Boom. He took it. So the red pill is, you're in a massively competitive space with lots of players, with a lot of resistance.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be hard. But the truth is, you seem like an indefatigable entrepreneur who wants to win, and your execution seems solid.
Thank you.
So when it's me handicapping it, I would say, not yet, but I really want to see if in 3 and 6 months, if you're still doing this, right? Because that's another tell for me. Like, okay, I've got two massively conflicted investments, but I don't know that he's going to succeed with this idea, but I get the sense that you're going to succeed in life. And that's my gift as an angel investor, to be able to look at somebody and feel their passion and then look at their execution, put those two things together, passion, execution, and if you times them by each other, that's you get this sort of output factor, right? So if you have like a 10 in passion and your execution's like a 6 right now, 60, and then if you're somebody who executes at a perfect level, like Travis from Uber or Elon, and they have a 10 passion, it's like 100. So I actually, in my mind, make these scores up. It sounds crazy. And so what I wish for you is the passion's there. Mm-hmm. Keep working on the execution. Mm-hmm. So you've bitten off a lot. Feels like you might be trying to boil the ocean.
It's ambitious.
Yeah, a little bit of a red flag for me also. Like, oh my God, trying to do four things at once. I know another company doing one of the four. I know another company doing three out of the four, but they added one every 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit of a red flag there, since we're in the radical candidness portion of the program. So that's how people are going to perceive you. Massive passion, solid execution, overambitious boiling the ocean. So then your counter to that, right, because this is a back and forth, is to prove it by nailing one category. Mm-hmm. And that's how your credibility is. If in 3 months you say, hey, you know, we had that interaction, da-da-da, why don't you let you know, like, we got this thing working and we have these three clients and here's our NPS score, Net Promoter Score, and here is what they said about us and here's what they're paying us. I know it's only three people, but They started by us managing like two buildings each, and now we're up to six buildings, and we doubled the price, and they wrote these testimonials. And by the way, of our three customers, one of them asked if they could invest in the company, so they invested 25K in our convertible note. So then you would be connecting the dots with me and answering those questions that I have.
Sure.
Right?
Yep. So we have five, and right now private beta, and we'd love to show you our public beta. Thank you so much,
Great
Jason.
Job.
Thank you.
I like them. Very solid, huh? Very solid.
James of passion. I've been sleeping on couches for 13 months.
I like that. I like that. He just told me in my ear, I've been sleeping on a couch for 13 months. You know what? You know who's sleeping in a conference room right now? I literally was emailing with Elon, and I was like, hey, am I going to see you this weekend? What's up? It's me name dropping. He's like, yeah, let's hang out. I said, I heard you're sleeping in the conference room. He's like, I like it. I was like, I remember you lost all your money, but the last time I checked, you have like $10 or $20 billion. You're sleeping in a sleeping bag in the conference room. That's like the level of commitment. Like, if anybody here is going to Web Summit or Summit at Sea or some bullshit summit or whatever, TEDx, Phoenix, Boulder, TEDx doesn't matter unless you're at the real actual TED, not the like fake TED. Like, Elon's sleeping at the factory and he just said, fuck it, instead of 2020, let's do 500 cars a year in 2018. The whole team is like, what? I mean, you can read about this stuff in the press. And all of a sudden, it's like, I have somebody emailing me from my portfolio who hasn't released their product yet, and they're like, hey, I'm going to Web Summit, and it's $8,000. I'm like, you're spending $8,000 on travel? They're like, oh, no, we're spending $12,000 on travel and $8,000 on the booth. I'm like, you're spending $20,000. What's your customer acquisition cost? How many customers do you get? They're like, what's customer acquisition cost? I'm like, what's CAC? Oh, my God. Cancel everything you're doing. Do not go to Dublin or Lisbon or wherever the fuck you're going. Like, please stay home and figure out your business because the lack of credibility right now is glaring. And that's one of the things you have to do is be self-aware as an entrepreneur. If you're not Larry Page or Sergey or Zuckerberg yet, that's cool. Stay home. Figure out your damn business. Get your customer acquisition costs. Get some sales going. Take the work seriously. We are living in a time of massive entitlement. Massive entitlement as a country and as an industry. Everybody is so soft. Soft. Nobody is hard. Be hardcore. Everybody's soft. Everybody's flopping. Westbrook laying on the ground. Oh God, Bogut knocked me down. Can I get a flagrant? It's like, get up and play the game. Like seriously, it's like literally the NBA is soft now. Like Patrick Ewing, Charles Oakley, like set some screens, put the ball in the basket. Let's play hardcore basketball.
All right.
No more entitlement. Okay, I'm sorry.
This is Carla.
Okay, here we go. Sorry, I'm all worked up today.
Slight alternative format. So Carla's just going to explain her product and
okay.
the obstacles you're having with the product, but not actually showing anything.
Okay. Yep.
So basically my question is, I'm in the civic tech space.
Okay.
My partner is David Capelli over here.
Hey, David Capelli.
From Tech Miami. Basically, I've won over the last probably 5 or 6 years, 6 or 7 different major hackathons.
Great.
With these great civic applications.
Okay.
The issue is everybody talks about diversity and they talk about they want comprehensive solutions. And then when you get there, you're trying to make contacts, whether it's here at Microsoft
yep.
with civic tech, or it's the government, or it's a venture group, and you're looking at our solutions and the solutions that I've built have been dealing with minority majorities in cities, closing the digital divide and other issues that have been there, and winning. Everything from Harvard to Code for America,
yep.
and then not seeing a follow through, and
right.
trying to chase people, and sure. they're going like, "Yeah, we love you." They've given you something to start with, and then there's nothing.
Got it.
And so, how do civic entrepreneurs like ourselves
right.
really begin to see these solutions and work to scale them?
Okay, it's a good question, And this is going to be the real talk section.
Yeah, I want the red pill.
Should we have the red pill?
I want the red pill.
It's real talk
time.
Okay.
Because I'm sick of the diversity bullshit.
Okay.
And all that stuff. Let's get real.
Let's just. It'll be very real for now. So let me mansplain exactly what's happening. I won't mansplain it. No, in seriousness, I think one of the things I've seen happen is when entrepreneurs in this millennial generation, they're very driven by purpose, right? And this is a great thing. It can also be a negative signal. So investors, in my experience as an entrepreneur now, they're looking to get the massive possible return as they can on money. Because, as you all know, the way we get paid is we invest $1 million or $100,000, and if the 100,000 turns into a million, we get 20% of that difference. That's called the carry. So if I turn 100,000 into a million, I get 20% of 900,000. It's nice money, right? Hey,
yeah.
It's a good life if you can make it happen. So when they place those bets, they're looking at who is the most marauding capitalist who will return the most money. Now, when I meet people and they say we're a B corporation or we're doing civic stuff, and anytime you're artificially narrowing your market, they literally, these investors, just put you in a different bucket. In their mind, they just put you in a different bucket. So now you've basically, by saying the word civic, and let's face it, like Uber is a civic organization, Airbnb are civic organizations.
Yeah.
They're making cities more livable, whatever. They would never call themselves civic.
Okay.
Because they would never want anybody to think that there is any reason that they exist other than making huge amounts of money and returning massive amounts of capital. That's when they're talking to investors. Now, when they go out in public, you'll see those companies talk about things like, hey, we're helping people make a living and lower their costs and rent out their apartment or on-demand employment. There's a lot of virtuous things. But what I always tell people when they put in their pitches, and we're going to give 10% of our proceeds to charity, and we're going to do this for charity, we're gonna do that. All that does with investors is just signal, oh, not a marauding capitalist, right? And that's what they want, is marauding capitalists. So here's the hack.
Yeah.
Lie. Oh, Jason, hi.
Yeah.
I have an idea, and it's going to make a ton of money.
Yeah.
In fact, it's so unbelievable that somebody has not done this idea before, but it's going to print money and we're going to have a virtual monopoly. It's going to be completely unfair and we're going to raise our prices every year and we're going to build extensions to our product line. This thing is going to have a 70 or 80% margin. We're only going to need 20 people to run the company. I think it's going to print money. And let me show you the evidence that this will print money.
Awesome.
Then make a shit ton of money and then deploy it to change the world like Bill Gates did. When Bill Gates 1.0 was going out and doing his thing, he was, according to a lot of books, he was, and there's a lot of Microsoft people here, I don't know if anybody had Bill Gates and been in a meeting with him. He was known in his younger years for being a radically candid individual.
So how do I do that? When I go in there,
you have
and
to,
I'm a black woman and I go in there and I'm like, I'm at it.
All right, well, that's another wrinkle, which is,
yeah, so
I want to know, there's a double standard.
How do I go in there and like get shit done?
So here's the thing. What I found working with women is, in my career, 25 years of doing this, women have to do somewhere between 25 and 50% more work to get the same credit. That's just the reality.
I know. I've been chasing Scott here at Microsoft for about 3 years.
It's just the expectations are high. So I think what you have to do is you have to take that fire and put it into your game.
Okay.
And I would look at your whole cohort of ideas and say, hey, I'm being judged at a little bit harsher. Maybe people don't expect as much from me. And you know what? Listen, I grew up in Brooklyn. I didn't go to Harvard. I didn't have a tech degree. You have a much better pedigree than I do. I mean, I went to Fordham and barely got through. And, you know, there was like a time when people like, you know, I didn't take me seriously, right? And it made me really pissed off. Like, and I couldn't get any of the magazines to let me write for them in New York when I was doing Silicon Alley Reporter. And I was like, you know what? Fuck this. Like, if they're not letting me write for them, I'm going to make my own magazine called Silicon Alley Reporter. And I made a stapled photocopy newsletter and I gave it out to people. And I was like, here's my magazine. And they're like, That's eight pieces of tabloid paper folded in half. It's not a magazine. I was like, no, it's a magazine because we did a photo shoot for the cover. Okay, this kid's delusional. Then I came back and it was 36 pages. Then I came back and it had a glossy cover and shitty paper on the inside. Then it got, the paper on the inside got a little better. And I was just like, you know what? I am just going to put it in their fucking faces every month when I get that next issue out. It's going to be bigger and a little bit better.
All right.
And I just put it into my work. And you know what? You can see like that I rub people the wrong way for a long time in my career. And I the way I look at it is if they were going to try and stop me, I was going to just kick my way in.
Okay.
And all these events that didn't want to give me a ticket and I couldn't get in, I just lobby crashed.
That's right.
I just literally went to the lobby and hung out in the lobby and I just interrupted people as I came in and out until finally Esther Dyson and Tim O'Reilly, who were running the conferences back then, like literally both of them at two different events were like, here's a ticket. Don't tell anybody to give you a ticket. Stop lobby crashing. Just act like you belong here. You know, like literally, it just took a while. And you know what? Like, yeah, it sucks to be an outsider, but you can just put it into your work. So keep iterating and keep connecting those dots. And I'll tell you something, when you narrow the focus, just like the speaker before us, the presenter, if you narrow your focus and you execute on something smaller and the results are undeniable, that's when I think that when the results are undeniable, the bias tends to go away. There's bias in the world.
Yeah.
There are racist people in the world. Overall, these investors are very driven by returns. I can tell you if the person is Indian, black, straight, gay, trans, whatever, if the results are there, they will literally like throw their grandmother out of the way onto the ground and be like, oh my God, you're the greatest thing ever. Can we give you a check? I've seen it before. All they care about is results.
What is some advice to being able to get that proof of concept with like working with a Microsoft or working with, you know, a bigger entity that's going to really be that mentor and that person that's going to give you the opportunity. Because it's the one thing that I know that I'm facing and that Dave's facing is that we've got folks, we even work up the money. So a lot of times it's like we've got someone who's going to do that and we just need to be able to get a partner like Microsoft because it's a cybersecurity issue or fintech issue that we can't, you know, go to market without getting, you know, working with a bigger partner.
I think being relentless, like, you know, like it's a numbers game as well, like
sure.
Going to four partners, five partners, presenting it and then asking them candidly, what would it take for us to be a partner?
Gotcha.
So when people tell me no, I would always say, okay, what would it take if for me, what would I have to prove to you if you to buy an ad in the magazine? And they'd be like, I don't know, like 10,000 people reading it. I'm like, well, we have 4,000. And they're like, yeah, come back when it's 10. And I was like, okay.
Okay.
And then I came back to them. It's 15 now, so you can't say no. And I like write it down on a piece of paper. This person said 10. So that's a really good way to call people on their bluff. But I think another thing, you know, asking for mentorship and going out and finding it was something I did early on in my career, and it worked. So I had David Hershkovitz from Paper Magazine, Jan Wenner from Rolling Stone, Graydon Carter from Vanity Fair, any of those folks who were like the big players in New York, I literally asked them for advice.
So I can have you as my mentor?
You can officially come to two of the launch incubator sessions this year, sit in, and I will have coffee with you after each one, and we will look at your project and try to make it better.
Thank you.
Of course. That's what I do for a living. Try to mentor people and then make money off of their hard work. I'm not altruistic about this. I want the money. Like if you got that much passion and you're that pissed off about it, like we get that, if we take that, like, you know who Cyclops is in the X-Men? Anybody know who Cyclops is? Right, like, until Professor X gave him the visors, he was a liability. But then once he got the visors on and he could, like, point that laser, he was the leader of the team. Like, he was the guy who...
I'm stuck in Microsoft here, and Microsoft, civic tech folks.
Good. You're like Cyclops. We just got to get you the right visor so you can put that energy in the laser. Hi, I'm Jason.
Hey, Jason. Brian. Nice to meet you.
Brian, 3, 2, go.
So my question is about for early stage founders. Paul Graham has a great essay about achieving ramen profitability.
Sure.
And the whole idea being you should be cash flow enough that you can live off of ramen and survive. Curious your thoughts on, you know, how crucial that is prior to raising an angel round, particularly to be able to demonstrate that you don't need the next 3-6 months runway.
So Paul's brilliant guy and very successful. That is great advice for people without kids, private school, you know, spouses, houses, the whole bit. So, you know, Y Combinator has always had a bias towards young people, two developers, nobody on the team who's not a developer, because they know that if they give them 15K, which is what they used to give them, like 8K per person, where they raise 100,000, it can last a long time. So it's good advice, but anybody who is above the age of 23 and has a child or a life, like this kind of breaks down a bit, doesn't it? And so that's why a lot of people say, just back to real talk, you know, it's a young person's game. And once you have kids and you're older, it gets harder to be an entrepreneur. That's true. It doesn't mean it's impossible. What the updated advice I would say towards to Paul Graham's is, forget about ramen profitability. That's for kids out of school, I think. What he's really getting at, and what I think is really smart about what he's saying is, keep your company low burn. So I tell people, have low burn culture until you figure it out. Because here's what happens. You have a fuse, and the fuse and the length of the fuse, it's like how many months you have of runway, and then how much you spend is how fast that fuse burns. Like if you've got a short fuse and it burns fast, like boom, startup blows up. So if you're spending $100,000 a month and you raised $500,000 and you light that fuse, guess what? You now have 150 days and it is scary. But if you raise the same amount of money and you're only burning 25K a month, oh my God. Now you have a lot more runway, 20 months to figure it out. So you always want to keep the burn low. No office space, you know, minimum salaries, as low a salary as you can. Using the cloud, not buying a bunch of servers, all that stuff. It's very virtuous. I've seen companies that were very promising, and if they had 6 months more, they would have figured it out. And they burn money too fast. They just went a little too crazy.
Along those lines, and with Eric being here tonight, as an early stage founder who's given himself a year, how long would you say you would work on your first idea? Because you need focus on, I think, one thing at a time. Then, and being
before
willing
pivoting.
To say, moving on to the next idea and pivot to the next thing.
Yeah,
be
so
lean.
You got good questions. Pivot or persevere there is no clear answer. And it takes a lot of introspection. Many times, a company like Twitter just feels like a little niche product that doesn't matter. And then somewhere in month 20 or 25, Ashton Kutcher and, you know, Larry King get into a Twitter battle and the whole world knows what it is, or some senator named Barack Obama, you know, joins the platform. And it was like Robert Scoble, me, Obama. Robert Scoble had 20,000 people. I had like 15,000. Obama had 10. This is literally the leaderboard at Twitter in the first year. And then all of a sudden, Obama wins the nomination. He goes to 1 million. And then we're, you know, Scoble and I are still hanging out at 50,000. Like those, if you can stick around, those moments can happen. And I've seen it over and over again where a startup is doing this, and then they figure something out and it goes like that. But what's most important is you as the founder are in love with the idea and you still believe in it. So when I have founders come to me and say, should I quit? Should I pivot? I say, what does your gut tell you? Do you love coming to work every day and working on this? Does your team love it? Or do you all have the sense that it's not going to work and you're spinning your wheels and you're just afraid to shut it down or afraid to take the remaining money and give it back to investors and give them 25 cents on the dollar back, or take that 25 cents and come up with a new idea? And that's really what we have to do, is have a frank discussion with your team. It's a pretty good indicator if you're not using your own product, you don't love coming to work on it every day, just pull the plug, give the money back. I had a company do this recently where they're like, it's not working and we can give back 70 cents on the dollar and we feel really bad. I was like, don't feel bad. I expect 7-8 out of 10 investments I do to fail hard. I expect 1 out of 50 to become a unicorn, 1 out of 100, something like that, and that's fine. So Yeah, give the money back. Who cares? And then you've built credibility and go take whatever, you know, go to Coachella or 2 weeks and come back with a new idea.
Cool. Thank you.
Go to the Sahara tent. You know,
appreciate it.
You find yourself there.
Okay.
One more?
Two more.
Two more, okay.
Yeah.
Next time, let's book 6 hours for this.
Yes, I agree.
I feel like I'm just getting warmed up. I feel like my best advice is going to come in hour three. Hey, I'm Jason.
I'm Cynthia.
Cynthia, pleasure.
There you go, Cynthia.
How do you feel it's going so far, Cynthia?
What's that?
How do you feel this is going so far?
This is fantastic.
Good.
I'm having a great time. You know, you could have a second career as a comedian if you decided to do that.
So maybe a TV show.
Hopefully a TV show, right.
Wait for it.
I'm the founder of Team U, and Team U is solving a... supposed to be up there.
So
Team U is solving a big problem in a trillion-dollar industry. We have a...
I can see it from here. Go ahead. Trillion-dollar industry?
Trillion-dollar industry, which is education.
Got it.
42% of students today in school, who is our future workforce, are disengaged. They're not paying attention because for all kinds of reasons.
Sure.
So we solve that problem. And we solve that problem by engaging them in a game that rewards them for positive behavior. They get points for that behavior, and it turns into a bank account that they can manage, and so it's a learning tool.
Okay, you're creating a currency that rewards kids for participating.
Participating, showing up on time, being engaged, doing their homework.
Very powerful stuff.
Helping out other students.
Great.
Social emotional learning. Because it's a point system, because it's digital, they're also tracking. So the teacher is able to improve their own performance. The principal is able to improve the performance of the entire school. And the student can track their own behavior.
Great.
We've got 14 schools that represent about 280 total in a district. It's a few schools in every district. 280 schools is about $1 million worth of revenue.
Wow.
We launched last year. In the meantime, after we launched, so I just wanted to show you what this looks like.
Yeah, show me what it looks like.
So the teacher works from, this is device independent, it's a web application. So the teacher works from a screen like this. Obviously, students on one side, list of things they want to recognize the students for on the other side.
Oh my God, look at DS. What a teacher's pet. Keep going. Unbelievable.
There's a really interesting comment, though, because this is all digital, because it's tracking, the teacher can look and see if they've got teacher's pets.
Is that transparent to everybody or no?
That dashboard. That dashboard is transparent to everybody.
Okay. Cool.
Some teachers display it on the wall, some teachers don't.
Oh, really? Okay, interesting.
But the data is only transparent to the teacher, to the principal.
Got it.
The student can track their own.
Cool.
But the interesting thing is the teachers that we talk with that come back with surprises is they found that there's 3 or 4 students in every class that they just never paid any attention to at all.
Mm.
The smart, quiet kids.
Got it.
And they found out that when just through this, not spending a lot more time with those kids, but by acknowledging them through the system because they could see the teacher acknowledging them through because they track mm-hmm. their own behaviors, they track their own account statements. Those 3 kids started to blossom.
Oh, great.
And the behaviors in the rest of the classroom changed.
And I noticed it was saying something positive or being collaborative. So these were really the skills that kids need to have in the future, not just straight up learning math or what level of algebra, but just how are they going to be a leader? How are they going to have grit? How are they going to communicate with others? That's good stuff.
Yeah, all of that. And in addition, you know, when they're really finding out now when they're looking at brains and how brains learn, brains don't learn from cognitive input. They learn because there's an emotional connection with
sure.
the cognitive input.
Of course.
So this is improving the learning environment. So students
improving the teachers.
Completely changing the teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, what's really interesting is teachers, none of us have gone through environments where we've gotten positive reinforcement.
No, the opposite.
So it's not something that's native to any of us. So that's a big learning curve.
Yeah.
Once it happens, just a couple of times, the student response is so strong and so powerful that they don't have to work at it for a very long time.
Great.
Students can spend their points in an online store. This we made a super simple template that the school sets this up. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that are the most popular are privileges, like a phone call home with good news. Huh. And this is all set up literally like they're shopping on Amazon. The minute that they buy something, it debits the points out of their account. They can track that online.
Love
and,
it.
And here's the value. Here's how we get paid. Principals and superintendents are now accountable under the law for school climate, for a positive school climate. And this gives them the data to be able to manage the school and create that positive school climate.
Great.
So
awesome.
That's Team U. So my question...
Sure. Add a question. Sure.
I come to this out of the investment business, and I'm a value investor. I was a value investor.
Cool.
So I'm the finance guy on the team, and I have a tech guy and a strategist. Headlines are all about unicorns falling out and no more Series C, and so that's going to roll downhill. How do you value, you know, in this environment?
Sure.
We've done a small seed round. We're looking forward to our Series A sometime next year. How do we start to think about valuations given this environment?
So valuation in the early stage is a bit of a negotiation. So what is the, on the angel side, the angel is thinking, and there's different ones. Some of them invest because they have an affinity for the space. So there are some people who just love education. And so if they can double their money or even get their money back, but feel they have done something great, there are emotional investors who are valuation insensitive. And then you have investors who are what we would call like civilians or tourists, probably tourists, like dentist or somebody who got, you know, I don't know, a trust fund. So those investors tend to not think about valuation. Then you have investors like myself or people who do it professionally, and they're gonna say, what's a reasonable valuation where in my mind I can return 100x my money? That's what I think. Doesn't mean that there's a 100% chance of me returning 100% X. It means I can think about, okay, if this company was valued at, it has $1 million in revenue and they're valuing it at $7 million and I buy 3% of the company, you know, for $200,000, can I get back not just $2 million, but $20 million? Because if I can figure out how this goes 100X, so 100X would be a $700 million valuation. Okay, backing into a $700 million valuation means if you were getting 20 times EBITDA, you know, I can start to actually figure it out with a public market comparable or whatever. So, and if you can do something that goes 100X, there is some outside chance that you might figure out how to go 1,000 or 10,000X, because that does happen too if it becomes a super mega phenomenon. So none of that makes it easy, but that's how those two different groups of people think about things. And so knowing how they think, you can sort of craft, you know, how you want to raise money in the valuation. I advise people in my incubator, the goal, the ultimately if you win, the founder owning 9%, 19%, 12%, it's all going to be in that kind of range. If you're two founders, you might both wind up with 6% each at the end of the day, or 10% each at the end of the day, or maybe 20% each at the end of the day if you're super capital efficient. And so the quickest way to get there is to have the world's greatest investors come in. They are going to come in based on the execution and having a reasonable valuation. It doesn't have to be bargain basement. It just can't be insane. So really the focus should be on that $1 million revenue number and how do you grow it. And really the function of valuation is, as you know from finance, is how much money does this throw off? Cash flow, earnings, et cetera. And then what's the growth of that, right? So if it's growing, if it's doubling every year and it's throwing off, you know, 40%, like, okay, we got a really good business here. If it's going up 10% a year and it's throwing off 20%, this business is never gonna get 100X return. So all those variables come into play. Education is just a horrible, horrible vertical in terms of investment. It's hard, it's grinded out. The upside is the people who are into it are passionate about it and have a different type of mission. If it's me, there's two ways to go about a business like this. One is to make it ramen profitable, which it seems like it's might be with $1 million in revenue. So if it's ramen profitable, then you can really be selective about how you raise money, and you may not need to. Or just really getting a large number of people on the platform and having velocity. So because it's paid, you're throttling velocity. So sometimes I see people who just, they don't go for velocity by making it free and having a large number of people doing it and pushing out monetization, and having monetization be a discussion for year three. And then I see other people, you gotta sort of pick one of those, I find. The best companies have it just baked in from the beginning. Growth plus the thing. So like you look at Uber or Thumbtack, it's like, yeah, we have a very simple way we make money.
Right.
We were making money from day one, and they just focused on growth, and they made this small amount of money. Airbnb is a similar thing. We have a commission.
Well, you know, in this field, they've proven that there is a, it never happened before in education, where you had a velocity kind of approach, right? And now it's happened.
Yeah, Chamath has an investment in a company that lets teachers talk to students.
Right.
What's the name of that one? Do you know the name of it? It's lets them talk on SMS.
Well, there's the two, there's a
Remind. Somebody look it up on Social Capital.
Remind. It's
Remind.
The teacher talking to the parents.
Teacher talking to parents. That thing
right.
is just, they went for growth, and
yeah,
it's
completely.
Unbelievable.
It's in this, we went for revenue.
Which is fine, too.
But
two
part of it is because we have this value proposition that is now law. So schools have to do something around this.
Yeah.
And
so that can be nice. You got to play the long game, though, right?
And they've got budget.
What's the sales cycle? How long did it take to get $1 million in revenue?
Depending on the when we walk into the right school, we can talk to them on Thursday and be going on Monday.
Wow.
And so.
And that means they're paying a $500 a month subscription fee.
$3,000 a year.
$3,000 a year.
Yep.
So they can. That's easy. That's a no-brainer.
They, exactly. Per
when
school.
You talk to 10 schools, how many of them adopt it?
Our close rate 10. is quite low. We've got 14 full installations, and we've got 600 leads in our that are coming along. So you know, you do the math.
Seems like a huge winner to me, and especially if the parents can get an alert when one of these things happens, because you know every parent does, hey, what's your thorn? What was your rose today? With you know your son or daughter, and we do this every night. And I had to have a conversation with my daughter, and I said, you know, it would mean a lot to your mom, I bet, if you could remember what happened at school and just tell her, because she loves you so much. She really wants to know what happened. And when you tell her, watch her eyes light up. So try to remember when you come home from school what happened at school and tell her. And my daughter was like, okay, I'll do that. And then she started doing it. And then I was like, here's ice cream.
And with this, there is a parent portal.
Yeah.
Okay. And there's two things that really give us a competitive edge. It's positive only. So this, there's no demerits in here. There's no punishment.
It's nice.
Positive only. The whole.
I love it.
The whole focus is engagement. We've got a big retailer.
Where are you based?
Where
are you based? Where's the HQ?
Marina Del Rey, Los Angeles.
Marina Del Rey.
Yeah.
In Los Angeles. Oh, okay. It's very nice over there.
So yeah, just down the street from where you used to live.
Yeah. Nice to go down to the Ritz there. It's nice.
Yeah. But positive only, and then it's got to be
Sugarfish. Oh, good sushi. Just going back to my
Next time you come down.
I love it. I think it's fantastic. The fact that this is like when we were talking before, like entrepreneurship, revenue, execution is solid, passion, credibility. Like it's just got all of the, you just got that sense as she was pitching it. Like, yeah, this is pretty far along. You can really start to think, maybe there is something worth investing here. Maybe there is something worth pursuing. So just really well done. Big round of applause for Team
Great.
U.
Thank you.
Okay.
Execution is everything.
Okay, just one last very quick question.
Okay, I'll do a quick.
This is like
I'll
lightning
do a quick.
Round.
Lightning.
You have one
round.
Minute to answer
Great
this
job.
Question.
Great.
That's the type of company I would love to have in the incubator, by the way.
Hi, Jason.
Team U. Yes, hi.
Hi, I'm Abel Carroque. I run a San Francisco startup here, and we're going to make a shitload of money, actually. So
did you just say he raised a shit ton of money?
No, we are going to make.
Oh, you're going to make a shit ton
We're
of money.
We're going to make a lot
okay.
of money.
Okay, oh, that's what I like to hear.
Good.
Keep going.
I know. Okay, so we originally are based in Switzerland. We started a team in Switzerland, and we relocated here to San Francisco last year. And we are in this phase in which we have a product. We have been having clients already. We have revenue. And now we are looking at the next phase. Should we go VC? Should we go incubator? And the question I have for you is, what would you recommend to startups like us, in which we actually have a product, we have revenue, and we think it's a very solid product, and what's the best way for us to go to the next phase?
Yeah, so you've got a product with revenue, with customers, and so without knowing what it is, generally speaking, you've got a lot of the risk, you've de-risked your startup, right? Okay, you've proven that you have a can build a product and you've proven that people will pay for it, that puts you in, let's call it the top 5% of startups. So that's good. Now what would be the decision-making process is, what do you hope to build this into and how big can it get? So let's say your customers are people who want websites built and you're charging them $10,000 to build the websites for their storefronts or their dentist. It's like, oh my God, that's an incredibly exciting business if it was 1997, right? So that's where like you have to start looking at exactly what are we talking about here and how big is the opportunity. There's a lot of businesses that can very quickly, like service-based businesses, get to profitability and be a great business for the owners. That's why law firms and design consultancies and stuff like that, sometimes people who build products, they don't actually make it into a startup and raise money because then you have investors and you can't sweep the profits off every year. So I would take a deep look at that. I think there's a lot of times people who have a service-based business as opposed to a scalable software business with an 80% margin, they think they have to get caught up in having investors. When you get investors, now you have to have our philosophy. So you take my money or a big venture firm's money, now the fuse is lit. Whether you like it or not, you chose to take that money. That is high cost money. We're taking 20% of your company, 30% of your company, 10% of your company, whatever it is. We expect you to try to get a 100x return. That means if you get a 5x return and that would be great for you, that sale might get blocked later on by other investors, right? They might be like, oh, you want to sell for 5x and that would make you $10 million personally, life-changing money? You might be like, I want to do it. And they'd be like, yeah, you're not doing it. We're replacing you and putting other people in and bye-bye. So you really have to think all that through. But congratulations on getting yourself into that bucket. That takes soul searching. Really think about where do you see yourself in life 5 or 10 years and why you're doing what you're doing. Intentionality is something that a lot of entrepreneurs don't have. They get so caught up in their task list and their Kanban board and their Trello board and getting stuff done that they don't step back for a second and say, hey, why am I doing this? What's the goal here? Do I want to be a billionaire? Do I want to have 1,000 employees? I took a step back a couple years ago and I was like, you know what? I want to have 10 employees. I want to invest in 40 or 50 companies a year. I don't want to have a lot of stress. I want to be able to spend time with my kids. And I want to spend most of my time interacting with founders. Okay, let me start crafting a life for that, right? Let me start crafting a plan. So you got to think on a very personal level, what do you and your team see yourself doing in the next 5 to 10 years? Have intentionality, be mindful. And you can do this all with a Calm.com app for $10 a month.
Of course.
A little plug in there for Calm.com. Great job.